We've been to all four corners of Britain in our quest to interview the great and good of entertainment. Comics, actors, writers, politicians, singers, dancers and choreographers. It doesn't matter who they are. They've all given me their own take on the world they live in and have, in their own way, helped to define what makes Britain great. So join me and my assistants as we get another insight into the marvellous and enigmatic world of showbiz here on Beyond the Title.
Northern Irish broadcaster and journalist Peter Dixon tasted his first feast of fame during the 1980s when he became the regular newsreader on BBC Radio 1's afternoon show alongside Steve Wright. Throughout the 90s, Dixon became the announcer for ITV's biggest game shows, including Bruce's Price is Right and Family Fortunes. Yet in 2004, he secured arguably his career-defining role as the official voice of The X Factor. I caught up with the man behind the voice to talk heroes, broadcasting, and the secret to classic Saturday night TV. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Peter Dixon.
How you doing?
I'm very good, thank you.
Excellent, excellent. So yeah, this is Josh. He's written all the questions for you today.
Hi, Josh, how are you?
Hello.
Good, good. Thank you very much for asking me to join you today. It's really nice. And I saw your story, Josh, and I've read about you, and I was really, really deeply impressed by what you're doing. I mean, this is an amazing thing you're doing. And I'm very, very, very honoured and pleased to be here today to talk to you.
Yeah, thank you very much. So, if it's all right with you, Peter, we'll just get straight into it. I mean, all the questions have been written by Josh. So if he's gotten any of them wrong, don't shoot the messenger. Yeah, he always gets one or two wrong. So don't worry. Don't be offended. Okay.
Well, that's all right, because I probably get one or two of the answers wrong as well.
All right then, good. That's all right. Everyone's on the same page. Right then. We'll get on to the major highlights of your career in a second. But you're in a unique group of people with possibly Alan Dedicote and Mitch Johnson to have one of the most unmistakable voices in the country. But not many people would know your face. So in this instance, how easy is it to maintain your anonymity?
Well, it's one of the great perks of being a voice actor, I think, is that nobody knows what you look like. And that may seem like a strange thing to say, because these days, particularly, a lot of people, particularly young people, are attracted to the idea of being famous. I've never been interested in being famous or being recognized in the street. I've just been interested in doing the work that I do. And so being able to work almost anonymously, as you rightly say, by just using your voice and not your physical visual appearance, has its benefits, because I can walk out of the studio having spoken and been listened to by millions of people. My voice is recognized by a lot of people in many countries, but yet I can walk down the street and nobody knows what I look like. So I think, you know, guarding your privacy and your anonymity is, for me anyway, is one of the perks of being a voice actor rather than a visual actor.
Mm. And this isn't a question next, but I've just noticed you're sat in your home studio you're in at the moment.
Yeah, this is what I call the bunker. Yeah, it's my studio. It's where I do a lot of my work. I used to probably do about 50% of it in here and 50% in various production studios in London. But now I work more and more in here, particularly during the pandemic lockdown that we are now in. Most of the studios up until now, they're slowly coming back, but they've been relying on people like me having a home recording facility to work from. Mm-hmm. So I'm very glad that I built this place many years ago, and I've, you know, it's come into its own during this time. But it's great to be able to work from home. That's another one of the perks of being a voice actor and not having to rely on cameras and lighting. You can work from almost anywhere nowadays with the right equipment.
Yeah. So you've basically just answered two questions that I was thinking of, as soon as I noticed you was in the studio, I thought, oh, throughout the whole pandemic, he's been able to work from home as well. So
what I'm sitting in now is what's called a sound booth, right? So it's not only does it stop sound from coming into it, because it's got six layers of plasterboard between me and the outside world, and an air gap filled with rock wool, which is a sound absorbing material. And over there, I've got a pretty soundproof door, double glazed door with neoprene gaskets. And so no sound can come in here. But more importantly, you see this padding on the wall here behind me. These are acoustic tiles. They're made from a special kind of acoustic foam, which absorbs sound energy. And the fact that this texture on the wall here, any sound hitting it dissipates and scatters, so it doesn't come back onto the microphone. So it means it's a very dead space. There's no echo, no reverberations, and nothing can come into it. So it's a perfect recording environment for recording dry vocals, which then an engineer, if you wish to, could add reverb or echo onto it, or treat it in any way that he wanted to. So getting that perfect vocal sound is important for anyone recording their voice. Mm-hmm. And so this booth that I'm in now helps me to do that.
There's a heck of a lot more science to it, isn't there, than what the person in the street would think. Just by saying, oh, I'm a voice artist, they'd just think, oh, you could do that into your phone. But there's a lot more behind it than that.
Well, there is. I mean, if you want to go, you can record on your phone. In fact, I know that on at least one instance in America, an advertising agency, quite a big one in Los Angeles, asked a voiceover artist to provide a demo sample of their voice. And this person wasn't in a studio at the time. And so he recorded his voice on his mobile phone and sent it in. And the agency loved it so much that they felt the quality was all right, that they used the actual recording he'd recorded on his phone on air in on a television commercial in America. So it just goes to show you that, while I wouldn't be happy doing that, some people are. Maybe it was the kind of read they were after, or maybe it was the kind of sound they were after. But mobile phones now are pretty good. The microphones aren't, they're not the same as the one I'm using, which is probably about, I don't know, £1,000 to buy. Mm. But, a mobile phone can actually work in some instances quite well.
Yeah, Josh is in the process of setting up his own studio as well. And it's amazing what you have to think about. Because beforehand, before all of this pandemic, before this year, we would go to London with a Tascam, and we'd go and sit in a room somewhere in London and we'd record it like that. But and now we've spent quite a lot of equipment, quite a lot of money. All the equipment's packed away, actually, in a nice new briefcase for when we eventually do get to go to and from London again. But it's always evolving, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, a Tascam, I've got one of those, Josh. I've got a Tascam, and I used it before. I can use it when I'm on the road. It's very good. I mean, the microphone in that is really good, and provided you are in a room that's not too reflective, the soft furnishings in the room, and you've got curtains you could close perhaps, then you can get a reasonably good sound. I've recorded on the road. I've been in hotel rooms, and the best way to record in a hotel room is to literally use the duvet on the bed and drape it over an upturned ironing board, so that you turn the ironing board upside down and the legs of the ironing board are pointing in the air like this, right? And you put the ironing board on a table, and then you drape the duvet over the top of the legs of the ironing board, and hey presto, you've got a little space that you can record in. And I've done the X Factor from underneath a duvet. I've done huge advertising campaigns that way. When I can't get to a studio, I just literally have to create a dead space in a room that sounds good. And it doesn't matter what it looks like. It doesn't look very pretty, but boy, it sounds great. And you can create really good audio by just using a little bit of ingenuity and creative thought to get that sound.
And you've got to make sure you pack it away, otherwise that's something you've got to explain to housekeeping.
Absolutely.
You made a fort.
Well, right. in the industry we call them pillow forts.
Yeah.
You can pack pillow, you can build a little igloo with pillows in a hotel room. So I mean, yeah, there's a lot of explaining to do if you don't unpack it.
Yeah. Right, let's get back to some of your actual questions, because that was just a tangent on studios that I wanted to know about then. Sorry. So one of the striking things about your early career is you were at Radio 1 when it was still featuring many of the, in brackets, old-style presenters. Now, to what extent did you get the vibe that the station was crying out for change? And what was it like working alongside Steve Wright?
Well, firstly, yes, I was at Radio 1. I think it was I joined it while I was working at Radio 2 as an announcer, and I was... I met Steve Wright in the canteen one day and we got talking, and he had characters on his show. And I had always wanted to do voice characters. And so in this conversation, he said, well, why don't you come up with one and we can do it on the show? And so I did. And so that was, I guess, around about the late 80s, 85 to... 2001, I think I was with Steve. I'm getting confused. Late 90s, I think it was, till 2000s, I was with Steve. And at the time, the roster of DJs were the old guard. They'd been there for a long time. People like Dave Lee Travis, and there were many others there. You know, Bruno Brooks, I think, was there. Gary Davis. And they'd been there for a long time, Simon Bates. Radio 1 was a youth station, and these presenters were growing old with it. And so when the new controller, Matthew Bannister, came along, he recognised the fact that the audience for Radio 1 were predominantly 16 to 25-year-olds, and yet its presenters were 35 to 50-year-olds. And so there was a disconnect with the audience. So he took the decision, a very bold decision, almost overnight, to replace 90% of the presenters with younger ones. Mm-hmm. It caused a great deal of, as change inevitably does, caused a great deal of upset amongst the listeners and also the presenters who had to find other work. But I think it was a necessary thing to do. And Radio 1, I don't think, would have survived had he not done that, because the audience was growing old with it, and the audience for Radio 1 was diminishing because the younger people were going to commercial radio, where the DJs and presenters were younger. Mm-hmm. So I think Radio 1 wouldn't have survived in its current form had he not done that. Working with Steve Wright was great fun. It was radio's so immediate. You don't have to have scripts. You don't have to have sets or cameras or lighting. You can literally create anything from nothing, and working with him was great. He was not only a great DJ, a great presenter, he was also a wonderful producer. He was a natural radio person. He understands the medium more than anybody I know, and he knows how to do it. And so I learned a lot from him, and it was terrific fun working alongside him. And I'm, you know, I look back on those days really very fondly.
Yeah, fond memories. Well, in 1995, you made the brave move into Light Entertainment when you secured a role as voiceover on Bruce's Price is Right. Now, how daunting was it to reprise the "come on down" catchphrase?
Well, when you take over a show like that, I mean, it's been going now for, I don't know, in America, certainly maybe 50 years, 60 years, who knows? Bob Barker was the original host in America. In this country, The Price is Right has been presented by Max Bygraves. And who else has done it now? I think there was... my memory's failed me.
Joe Pasquale did a little stint, didn't he?
I think Joe did a series, and I did a series with Joe. But it was the most tremendous fun. But taking over a show like that, where there is a history to it, is... a little bit daunting, because you've got to to carry on that tradition, but also kind of find a way to reinvent it in a way that is yours, to put your stamp on it. Mm. But as is so very often the case with these very famous shows, they've been running so long that there is a tried and tested formula that works. Yeah. So you can't change too much about it, but you can just make your own personality present on it, which is what I tried to do. But working with Bruce was the most tremendous fun. Again, there's somebody who is known as Mr. Show Business for a good reason. He had been in show business for 65 years, something like that. From a young boy, he literally was treading the boards before he was a teenager. And so I learned a lot from him. I'd never met anybody before or after who could walk onto a set and electrify a studio audience in the way he did and had them eating out of the palms of his hands within about 2 seconds. He just had a natural affinity with people, and he did it with his eyes. He had these incredibly mesmeric, sparkling eyes that he walked around the studio floor with, looking at each and every one of the audience as he went, and they were drawn into him. And he could probably just walk out and say nothing and get a standing ovation. He was one of those people that really was marvelous to watch.
Well, just 6 years later, you became the official continuity announcer for Channel 4's sister station, E4. Yeah. Now, having such a young audience, how did you adjust your style to appeal to the target demographic?
Well, these are great questions, Josh. you're really putting me through the ringer. Right, so... it's a good question, by the way.
Yeah, he's quite thorough, isn't he?
He's laughing at me. the target audience for E4, as you rightly say, is a young audience. It's E4's youth channel. I took over the wasn't continuity. It was promo voicing for the channel. I took over as the promo voice for the channel from a guy called Patrick Allen, who sadly died, and they were looking for a replacement. I auditioned with a number of other people. They didn't want me to be exact duplicate of Patrick, but they wanted me to adopt the way that he and they had created this kind of character to sound. And I managed to do that reasonably well, I think, and got the job. The funny thing about the way that I approached the way the E4 approached their promos was that the voice I adopted was very Middle England. It was like the outraged colonel from Tunbridge Wells, very establishment voice. And I think the comedy in that came from the fact that I was speaking with this such received pronunciation, terribly posh, and yet the scripts were at odds with it. So I was saying odd things and sometimes quite outrageous things on these scripts. But because it was said in such a way, said in a way that I did it, it sort of sounded slightly more acceptable than if it had been a younger person or somebody who sounded more contemporary was saying the words. So for me, that was, again, a dream job to do because it was so much fun just to say, you know, outrageous things on television and be rude about programs and people and make snidey comments and just sort of get away with it. So we used to dream up the most amazing, one-liners, and the audience loved it because they just adopted me, and before me, they adopted Patrick as a kind of friendly old uncle kind of voice. And it just grew from there. And I had a very long association with E4. Again, as we mentioned at the very beginning of this talk, you know, things change, and over time, something comes along and replaces it. So I know nothing's forever, but while it lasted, it was the most fantastic fun.
Mm. Well, obviously, arguably your most celebrated role came in 2004 when you became the unmistakable voice of the X Factor. Now, what were your first impressions of the show?
Well, I saw the show in its pilot form. They had done a non-broadcast pilot of the show, and the sound supervisor, the guy that does the sound for the X Factor, I'd worked with him on a show before that called Test the Nation, with Philip Schofield and Anne Robinson. And he rang me up and said, they're looking for a voiceover to do the, to be the voice of this new show. He mentioned the name. It didn't mean anything at the time. He said, it's called The X Factor, I think. And he said, would you be interested in auditioning for it? I said, yes, of course I'd be interested in auditioning. He said, well, I'll get them to send you the pilot show. And they sent me the pilot show, and I watched it at home. And as soon as I saw it, I knew then that this was a show that A, was going to be huge, and B, it was the sort of show that I knew I could add value to. So I did an audition there and then and sent it back to the producers. And within a few days, I got the good news that I'd been hired. So that was, as you say, back in 2004. And then for the next 16 years, every autumn and Christmas season, I would be working on a weekly basis on what was then the biggest show on television. Mm-hmm. And remained as the biggest show on television for quite a number of years, not just in the UK, but globally as well. There are 40-something versions of The X Factor around the world, and the one that we made in the UK was also broadcast in America and in lots of other English-speaking countries. So, again, you know, without realizing it, you know, your voice is pretty much globally known as a result of just that one show. So it was a show I'm very pleased to have been associated with and proud to have worked on.
Now, in what year did you announce your departure from the series? I've got 2015 here, but I just might have got that wrong.
Again, years as the years go on and these things get lost in the mist of time, I think it was probably around 2015, yeah.
And Dermot had left. Right time to leave.
I felt it was, because the show was, there was a perfect bell curve that if you look at the audience graph, from 2004, it went up like that, and then there was a peak, and then it started to slide down the other side. There's nothing that The X Factor were doing wrong. It was still the same show, but there's only so much an audience can take of one particular format. Every format has its lifespan. Mm. Some of them come and go, like The Price is Right. It's been running for, as I said, 50, 60 years. You know, comes and goes. The X Factor will undoubtedly come back again at some point, I'm sure. Whether I'll be part of it, I don't know. However, I think that in 2015, Dermot had announced his departure from the show, and they had asked Ollie Murs to come and host the show with Caroline Flack. Mm. And so I felt that maybe this was a time to leave it on a high, you know. So I decided to leave it there, and then within a few weeks, they called me up and said, "We need you back." And I said, "I ummed and ahed about it. I thought, well, I might as well, you know, carry on then if they really think they want me back." So I said yes, and I stuck to the very last series, which was last year. Mm. When Dermot came back as well, as you know.
That's right, yeah. Well, in the early noughties, you also became the voiceover on the Paul O'Grady show on Channel 4.
That's right.
Now, what celebrity did you most enjoy announcing?
On that show, these things go in one ear and out the other. I know that sounds very cruel and rather blunt, but, I can barely remember what I did even half an hour ago in work terms. You know, if I stored up memories, and there are occasional flashes of things I remember, but I'm one of those kind of people that likes to look forwards rather than backwards. Mm. Although having said that, I did have to look backwards recently, because I just finished writing my memoir, which is a 330-page book about reminiscences and anecdotes about my career. So I've finished that now, and that's now literally gone on sale as an audiobook. Okay. And on the 25th of September, that will be available on through all normal outlets, bookshops, and Amazon. Oh,
it's going to print as well as audiobook.
Yeah, there's a paperback, a hardback, a Kindle version, and an audiobook. And the title of the book is very simple. It's just called Voiceover Man.
Yeah, yeah.
Me. Well, so it's all about me.
So on the audiobook, did you provide the voice on the audiobook as well?
Well, I thought about who could I get to play me, and I thought, oh, I can't do that. I'm a voice actor, so I'm going to have to do it myself, and I did. And you know, I'd never ever done an audiobook before, and I approached it with a great deal of trepidation because it's such a long thing to do. My book is 11 hours long. That may not sound like much, but when you read out loud, it's a very long way.
Yeah.
So it took me 2 weeks to record it because it's quite tiring reading aloud for that long.
Yeah, you can't read too long.
And I had a production company who helped me with the editing and so on. But with, you know, it was just a long, hard slog. So I have enormous respect for all voice actors who record audiobooks. It's you have to sit down for a long time and concentrate very hard. And particularly in novels, you've got to remember voices and accents that you've used for the characters. Because a character may appear in chapter one and not appear again until chapter 20. And you've got to remember the voices that you used. So it's not just the reading of the book, it's the initial research that you have to do. I think most voice actors who are good at this read the book at least twice before they begin to read it aloud. Mm-hmm. And the first reading gives them an idea of where the arc of the story. The second reading, they then focus in on the characters and begin to make notes about voices, what voices they might adopt for those characters, what accents they might use. They have to work out whether the character ages during the book, and if the character does grow old, how they're going to deal with that, you know, between chapter one and the last chapter. How's the voice going to change? So it's an incredibly complex thing with lots of moving parts. And so I don't think I'd be doing another one very soon.
Josh has just asked, did you have a director?
Yes, I did. Not in the studio with me, though. What I used to do, Josh, was I would read one chapter a day, and then I would record one chapter and then send it to the producer stroke director, who would listen to it and then give me feedback and notes, and maybe we would change one or two little things along the way, and then we'd go on to the next day and I'd record another chapter, and that process would go on until we finished it. So there was nobody with me as I was reading it as such, but there was, you know, pretty much daily feedback and commentary on how it was going.
Hmm. Now, there's always something a little bit eccentric about your delivery. Would you say that you're a little bit eccentric?
Aren't we all? Yeah, I think we're all slightly insane. Just with varying degrees. I think anybody that does what I do is a very strange job. So I think I must be slightly mad. But to sit in a padded room like this and talk to yourself is not normal. So that is eccentric in itself.
If we couldn't see the room and you told us you were sat in a padded room talking to yourself, it actually paints a completely different picture.
Yes, yeah. Josh is laughing at me again.
He's gone now.
He's gone. He's having a great time. Aren't you, Josh? Yes. These are great questions. These are great questions, by the way. Very good.
Josh has just said people have always said he should be in a padded room.
Well, there are worse places to be.
Yeah, exactly.
I've forgotten the question now.
That's all right. We'll move on. Looking back at your career, what is your proudest achievement?
There are several, I think. Well, one would be, this is a job I did in 2012, it was never to be repeated again, obviously, in my lifetime, was I was invited to be the commentator at the London Olympic Games beach volleyball, which was the most incredible, not to be repeated, unique experience ever, to sit in an Olympic event 2 meters from the touchline of an Olympic sport and commentate on it. That was an amazing experience in this fantastic venue that the London Olympics organisers had built on Horse Guards Parade in London, smack bang, bang in the centre of the most exciting city in the world at the most exciting time in history for sport, that was unique and never to be repeated. That was something I'm very happy to have done and proud to have done. Another thing I did, I gave a voice. Yes, I gave voice to a glove puppet that hadn't spoken for 45 years, Sooty. I was in an episode, a TV show, the Sooty Show. Yeah. They decided that they wanted to give Sooty a voice just for one episode. Some magic spell had occurred and he'd been given a voice. So they picked me, which was remarkable. So I'm unique in that respect, that I'm the only person ever to have given Sooty a voice in 40, 50 years that he's been alive. And so he's never spoken since.
No, that's a very good one.
Yeah. There are lots of little moments like that, I suppose, but those two stand out.
So how did Sooty talk, Josh has asked.
Oh, right. Well, I used the voice that I used for the X Factor, actually. And they wanted me to shout very, very loudly. So Sooty had this huge voice, which they put reverb and echo on. And on the little set that he was in a living room at the time on this particular scene. And I think Sweep comes in and says, casts a magic spell over Sooty. He gets a voice and he shouts really loudly. So I can't remember what the line was. But as he shouts so loudly, it's my voice, right? So as he's shouting, all the plates fall off the wall and the windows break and the curtains all fly out because it's so loud.
Brilliant.
And I love that. Another show I did, which I really loved, which nearly drove me completely mad, was a show for CBBC, Children's Television, and it was called Ooglies. And this was a show that really just is lots of little sketches about inanimate objects, like a computer mouse. You know, for instance, if you had a computer mouse, they'd put little eyes on it here and then they'd animate it moving along a desktop, for instance. And I had to, along with a lot of other actors, give these inanimate objects voices, but not work. We weren't allowed to use English words. We had to just use emotive sounds to express how the object was feeling or what it was doing. And inevitably it ended up with most things falling off high objects and smashing to bits on the ground. So you had to sort of imagine what they would sound like.
Yeah.
It was great fun to do, and it was nominated for a BAFTA, which I was very pleased about.
Very unique, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is that the last one there at the bottom? Yeah. Well, you thought of another one. Josh just thinking of another question. So Josh has just, this is a good question as well. Josh has just asked, do you work freelance or do you have certain contracts with certain stations? So obviously a lot of your work's with ITV, but then you've got Channel 4 and then the Olympics with BBC. So how does that all work?
Yeah, I've always been freelance, Josh. I've never worked, except for the early days back in the 80s when I worked for the BBC for 9 years. Again, that was under a freelance contract. So I had a contract with them, but I was never on the staff. And when I left the BBC many years ago, I've always been a freelance voice for hire, so I can work for anybody. But you're right. I mean, very often when a big series comes along, like the X Factor, for instance, that's a good example. they will contract me for the whole series. So it's not just show by show by show. It's there's a fee is agreed for the series. That's the contract. There's the number of hours you're going to work. And so that's how it works. Other things like commercials come along. Radio commercials can be on the day. You know, they ring me up and they say, we want you to say these words, and we agree a fee, and there you go, off you go. This is the life of a freelance. And some days, you know, even for me and for many other people in my position, you know, the phone may not ring some days, and you think, is something gone wrong? Those are the days you just get on with your other activities, like marketing yourself, because you are a business. And so you have to keep all your assets up to date, like your demo reels, your website, keep your accounts in order, and do all the administrative tasks that you may not otherwise have time to do when you're working. So it's a nice balance. And I've never, ever, ever been out of work ever in my life. And that, I think that's, for me anyway, that's remarkable. I've been so lucky and very, very fortunate to have been able to live my life like that and take holidays when I want to take them. Of course, when you're a freelance, you don't want to take holidays because you never know where the next job's coming from. So it's a difficult thing to get used to if you've been in a job and been paid a salary as such. Going freelance is quite scary because there's no guarantee of income ever. You have to literally rely on your own ingenuity and wit and get the work. Mm. But it's I wouldn't swap it, what I've done, for all the tea in China, as they say.
Well, this leads nicely on to our final question. We've already spoken about your upcoming book, Voiceover Man, an audiobook. But what is next for Peter Dixon?
Well, I'm two things at the moment. One is, again, it's related to my work, and I'm the co-founder and co-director of a company called Gravy for the Brain. An odd name, I know. But what it is, gravyforthebrain.com is an online voice acting training school. And we've trained something like close to 50,000 voice actors around the world, from South America to North America, Canada, most of Europe, the Middle East, and Australia and New Zealand. We have offices in all those places, and we have people on the ground, physical courses as well as events and online courses and mentoring. And so we train basically anybody who's never done voice acting before. We train them up to become professional voice actors in all aspects of the business, from delivering the goods, delivering the lines, to actually running a voiceover business. How do you do that? How do you market yourself? How do you get the work in the first place? So we teach that. So that business is taking up quite a bit of my time now, as well as the work that I do in the studio here. And I also have a shareholding in another business called reattendance.com. That's an online events company. So we will host online events for people and replicate a physical event online. And we dreamt this up about three or four years ago. We launched it at the beginning of this year, just before the pandemic struck. Yeah. So, I mean, it's unfortunate that this has happened, but it was perfect timing for our business, because so many people are now transitioning their events and their award ceremonies and meetings to online in the way that we're doing now, for instance. But reattendance allows you to scale up, and you could literally hold an event for 10 people or 10,000 people. It doesn't matter. We can cope with that, and we have exhibition spaces and social networking facilities, and you can exchange business cards, all the kind of things that you would do at a normal conference.
Yeah,
you can do online with reattendance.com. So that's a business that we're building right now to be version 3 coming up at the beginning of October. We're just testing the platform for to see how robust it is, and so far it's been great. So those are the things that I'm looking forward to doing.
What's in the pipeline, yeah. Josh said that's a great it's a great idea. That.
Yeah, thank you, Josh. I'm glad you agree. I mean, unfortunately, we all have to get used to you know, not traveling around the world anymore, you know, and not just from the point of view of the pandemic, because that will surely, you know, resolve itself in time. But I think we all have to be, well, this crisis, this COVID-19 crisis has forced us to think also about the environmental impact that our travel has on the planet. You know, air miles and, you know, hotels. And I mean, these things all have an impact.
Yeah.
And we've been far too lax, I think, in the past, in our attitude to the impact that our activities are having on the ozone layer, mainly environmentalists are now warning of impending catastrophe in terms of the melting of the ice caps and the rising sea levels, and also the heating up of the planet.
Yeah.
You know, I saw a very disturbing map the other day, a prediction by the end of this century. You know, most of the equatorial, sub-equatorial regions in the world will be uninhabitable. So we're going to see in the next 70 years, huge climatic migration from the south to the north or to the poles, where the weather will be slightly more favorable to live in.
Yeah.
So it is. Sorry to put a downer on it, but that's one of the reasons why I'm so keen on reattendance.com is it allows us to meet virtually. It's not something that any of us would like to have to do, but we have to be aware that there's a cost, there's a price to pay for travel.
100%. Well, have you got any more questions, Josh? No, that was brilliant. Thank you very much for your time today, Peter. I really appreciate you.
Right, that's great. Thank you, Josh. That's really kind of you. Thank you for that. And thank you for asking me to take part today. It's been great fun. I hope you've enjoyed it. And I hope I answered all your questions satisfactorily.
Yeah, it's been fantastic.
Thank you to our guest for being the subject of another Beyond the Title interview. If you liked this, why not browse the website and see if there's anything else that takes your fancy? Don't forget to like our Facebook page to receive updates on forthcoming interviews and to see more information about me and what I do. Thanks again, and hopefully see you next time.